Thank you for listening. This is the Legends Podcast by All Day Vinyl, and I'm your host, Scott Duddleson. After you finish this episode, please subscribe and rate it, and please check us out on Instagram at All Day Vinyl. Today, I'm here with Mark Howard, and we're having part two of our conversation. You could check out part one, where we talked about Mark recording and mixing Time Out of Mind and No Mercy with Bob Dylan. Today, we're going to talk about his work with Neil Young on the album La Noise, and also Tom Waits' Real Gone. So thank you, Mark. Thank you for joining again.
Yeah.
Appreciate having you. So La Noise by Neil Young is one of my favorite Neil Young albums. It's probably the stuff he did with David Briggs in the mid-90s.
Right, yeah.
And Neil notoriously has his own crew of people he works with, which now includes Rick Rubin. So tell me how you got involved, you and Daniel started working with him.
Yeah, at the time, Dan also had the same manager as Neil, Elliot Roberts. And so me and Dan had made a record called Black Dub, which was filmed. The record is filmed live as we were playing it. And so that way the recording and the film all lines up. It's not cut together. It's one piece and they're like filmed pieces. And so each song we did exactly that way. And so Elliot had showed these to Neil, and Neil really thought he really liked it. And he goes, why can't I have a record like that? And so Neil and Daniel Lanois started talking, and they agreed for Neil to come down to Dan's house in Silver Lake, a house called Bella Vista. And so I had set up a rig in the hallway of Dan's house. And he had a full studio in the basement with a Neve 8068. But it was, I didn't like the vibe in the basement. It was like a dungeon. And so he's got a beautiful living room and a beautiful hallway. So I just set up my rig in his hallway. And so, like I was telling you before about how my sound system works, I use a playback system that's got like big 18-inch subwoofers, and it's got like a multiple speakers towering. And so when you play back, stuff sounds bigger than real. So then it really happens and exciting, and it makes the artist happy and they really dig it. So when Neil decided to come down, we had tested all Dan's mics and I got everything all lined up and which guitars we could use and amps, and we picked the best of everything. And so we did all of our kind of like homework before he got in. And so it'd be like, oh, Neil's coming in tomorrow at noon. And we're there waiting, and Neil don't show up that day. And then like, he's coming in tomorrow, staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And so, all right, and show up the next day either, and like, what's going on? So he finally shows up on the third day, and he rolls in there. But before that, he had sent one of his techs with a van with all of his instruments and pump organ and a bunch of other, all of his amplifiers and stuff like that, guitars. And so when Neil eventually got there, he explained that he was waiting for the full moon. He claims that he can't work only on 3 days before the full moon. So he was waiting for that 3 days before the full moon so he can start recording. Because he claims if you record before that or after that, that you're not going to get as good as a performance or a vibe.
Is that how he's done his career? Or
I don't know, but that was for this particular record. He really wanted to push that. And so, the record took 6 months to make because we're waiting for all the full moons. And so eventually, once he came in, we started working, and it got to a point where Neil and he had some songs meant to be acoustic record. And so I developed the sound. I thought, how the hell am I going to better his guitar sound? I'm a big fan of
using the whole black guitar.
The acoustic end of it, and so this is supposed to be an acoustic record, just film each song on acoustics and stuff like that. But he had also brought a Rick to Les Paul, a 57 Les Paul gold top that he's painted black. And so
what he used on that, Hey My Mom.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's the classic. Yeah. Yeah. And then he's got this other guitar that it's a white Falcon Gretsch, and it's a special guitar because it's a twin stereo output. So the top three strings come out of one pickup and the bottom three strings come out of another pickup. So you split that into two amps. And so you have to play it a certain way. Mm. And so he plays like, you know, like crazy, like, da-da-ba-da-ba-da-da-da. So it's like a very stereo spread if you listen to that record.
Very psychedelic.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool. And so we started with the acoustics, and he had his acoustic there, and he called it Hank. And it was Hank Williams guitar. But Dan had a little Guild, little mahogany Guild. And I tested every pickup known to man, and I came up with LR bags. So I put the LR bags in that. And then so I mic'd it, and then I ran a DI of it. So I had a direct signal at the same time. And so we had Neil set up in this big, beautiful living room. And so I was in the hallway, but as we were checking the guitars, I had a couple of effects that I had on it. So when Neil would hit the low string of the guitar, it would trigger the sub harmonizer that I had, and it would just shake the house like an earthquake. It's like, what the hell is this? Though he'd never felt that off an acoustic before. So I thought, okay, this is good. He had a big smile. He really liked it. And so we ended up cutting Love and War, I think the song was. And if you listen to that, it's like in headphones. It's just got this sub. It's so warm and dreamy. Yeah.
And it's unlike anything that you've ever done.
Yeah. And so I was excited. I created a sound for him that he'd never heard before and never felt. And because I play and I got the speakers on, and it gives you that kind of fulfillment that you're live and you're on a stage and stuff like that. So I think that part of it really worked well for that. And then, so we had caught, I think there was another song called Peaceful Valley, something on that record. That was an acoustic song. And so that one, the low frequency didn't work as well as Love and War. And so we cut those two and he went away. We waited for the next full moon. And on the next full moon, he comes back.
Did you know you're waiting, or was that in?
Yeah. We were told that we were waiting for these full moons. So he comes back. And so then he's got the two electrics with him. And he says, I want to try Walk With Me with this Les Paul. And so we set up two Tweed amps. And he's got this special treatment on his amps where a Tweed amp has tubes in it. And what happens is the tube amps heat up and then your tone goes away because it's too hot. So he has these fans blowing cool air on the tubes, keep the amp cool as possible to keep the tone there all the time. And so he pulls out the guitar and I'm just, it's the same faders, everything. That's kind of, it's only like two channels or three channels or whatever. And then I got my effects coming back on another console. And so I got the speakers kind of turned up pretty loud. And then he hits that chord on that guitar and it just blew his mind. His pant legs were swaying. The house was also shaking. And we had to tape all the windows down. It was pretty serious sound. Yeah. So that became kind of like a bit of the sound. It was also another treatment that I did on that record. And it's something that I spend a lot of time in Jamaica and I do a lot of dub work. So I've got a lot of dubs on that record where, like these like real strange psychedelic sounds. And they're all done by this old Lexicon delay that's going to touch hold on it. And so I kind of developed the style the way I use it. And I can like hold words or sounds but you can lower them back. I'm just doing all this stuff on the fly as he's playing. And he's like, bro, what the hell is this sound? It's like, and so he was pretty excited about it. And so we had cut, a couple of those ones with that guitar. And we did it. And then he brought out the No, the White Falcon. Mm-hmm. And so I split the pickup and went into it. And then I that was the one that he may have played Walk With Me on. Yeah, I think that was the one, actually, not Blackie. Blackie, I think, was Hitchhiker.
Yeah, so tell me the story on Hitchhiker. That's the centerpiece of, to me, the album.
Yeah, well, he had written Hitchhiker, I guess, in the 60s, and there was a version of it, but he never felt it was complete.
Maybe you know the story, maybe you don't know the story, but what I read was he wrote it in the early mid 70s and actually played it for Bob Dylan.
Wow.
You know, Bob Dylan came over one day and played it, and Bob Dylan's comment on it was, "That's very honest." That's very honest. And Neil didn't know what to do with it, and right. Just kind of shelved it from there.
Yeah,
and it could pick us up.
Yeah,
30 years later.
Yeah, so it poked his head out again. This record, and so Neil would go away to Hawaii, and you know, Dan would call him up and said, "You got any new songs?" He'd say, "No, I'm sitting here over the rabbit hole, and nothing's coming out." And so it got to the point where, you know, like after he'd go to Hawaii, and then we'd get a call and saying, you know, I've written this one song, and I'm sure it was Hitchhiker. And he had finished it there. Anyways, he finally finished the last verse or whatever it was. And so then when he came back in, then I think that's when he performed it. And we had the film guy, the director, at Volek, his name was, and so he's a Canadian guy, and he came down, so it was like we're all Canadians in this room doing this record. And so we had projectors that we were projecting the sky and all the clouds kind of going by, and so we're doing the projections as we were recording him, and we got the front doors of Bella Vista open, and everybody in Silver Lake heard that record go down. I had it so bloody loud. And so
real quick, go back on Hitchhiker. So you had shared a story with me. I hope you could share it.
Yeah,
share it again. So when he was in Hawaii, he got some inspiration, and then brought that inspiration back.
Yeah. So he had said that he had finished the song, and he had this joint that he had smoked in Hawaii, and he thought, well, I wrote it on this joint. I want to record it on this joint. So he put the joint out. And he carried the joint all the way back for him. And so when we're about to record, he sparked it back up so he could be high on the other side of
the joint.
With the joint, yeah, yeah. So it was an interesting thing. But he had gone through he had a brain aneurysm kind of just before this record. And the doctor said, don't smoke weed, you know, like don't even do it. And so, you know, after the sessions, I would usually just take a little hit, you know. And I think it may have got him started again. I could be to blame. But yeah, so when he came in, you know, we recorded it after he smoked it. We listened back, and it was pretty incredible. And I had a lot of dub work on that track also.
It's a great song. And for anyone who's not familiar with it, definitely find it. It's not streaming, but you can find it somewhere. And it's a drug song. It's all about Neil's history with...
He says the word hash.
I think it's hash and opiate. I think he talks about everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And that. It's his autobiography, from what I understood of his drug journeys.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he wrote new was the last verse.
I think
about his family.
Yeah. And then after that session, he went away again. And during that session, Daniel Lanois got in a motorcycle accident and broke his ribs. And he was up for a while, or down for a while. And so Neil kept on saying, when are we going to finish? When are we going to finish? And kept calling him. And so at that time, there was a running joke, you know, about Lanois's last name. People don't know how to say it properly, and people call him Le Noise. And so Neil would always call Dan Le Noise. And so the record was supposed to be called Hitchhiker. And I did the tour, and they had a Hitchhiker shirts made for that tour. But as we were mastering, and as a joke, that became the name of the record based off of Lanois' last name. That's why it's called Lanois, which, you know, it was pretty crazy. We would drive up to Neil's ranch up in Northern California, and I brought some speakers with me, and we go listen to it up at his ranch. And
he's a barn. Is it the barn?
Oh, he's got multiple places. We stayed in what was called the White House, and that's where his band always stays. And then he's got Redwood Digital. I think that's the studio. But then he's got a couple of other houses. His house is pretty phenomenal. It's like a big log cabin added on over the years. It's huge, beautiful inside. But then he's got his car collection in a big kind of room. And then behind his car collection is his amp collection. It's just like a wall of every amp he ever had. It was pretty amazing. And then I said, Neil, didn't you buy like a train company that makes toy trains? He says, yeah, Lionel. I think it was called.
Yeah, Lionel.
Lionel, yeah. And so he brought us into this other building where he had this huge train set that he built for his son, one of them that was in the wheelchair. And so it was phenomenal. It was like, oh, it was like pretty huge. It was the size of a warehouse of trains and all kinds of different landscapes. And so it was interesting to see kind of how, what he's been up to and stuff like that.
I was, you know, you work with Bob Dylan, you work with Neil Young, these two premier icons of music history. How are they same and how are they different?
Lyrically, I think.
Working-wise.
Work-wise, yeah. They definitely got two different kind of work methods and how they work. And, you know, Neil is quite a, you know, set up with his full moon. But at the same time, Bob, he only likes to record at night. He said there's something about nighttime where things are a little more slowed down. And also he prefers to work at night. And Neil only works before the full moon. So it's crazy. So I think that's the kind of difference. That's similar to it, kind of their work methods. But as far as lyrics and stuff like that, I got to see it, you know, kind of firsthand. I'm of the opinion that they're very well read.
Yeah.
They've read the classics. They know all of that stuff. And I, you know, I didn't read any of that stuff, but I found out later by reading some of that stuff that some of those things may have been taken from
some creative inspiration.
Yeah. I was looking through this book and there it was, boom, right in front of me, Time Out of Mind. That's where I got it from. Yeah. So I think that's where, and as when we get into it, yeah, Tom Waits says he's pretty amazing with lyric, but he gets them from some sources too.
Well, let's talk about Tom Waits. You worked on Tom's album, I think it was 2004, Real Gone.
Yes.
And you, well, how did you get involved with that? Because that wasn't through the Daniel Lanois.
No. But there's a record company called Anti. And one of the guys there at Anti Records, he really loved to listen to Williams records. And so he had called me up and he said, his name was Andy Culkin. And he said, I'd really like you to make a record with Tom. And I proposed it to Tom and Tom's going to call you. And so I said, oh, wow, that'd be great. I'd love to make a record with him. And so we kind of left it at that. And Tom never called. About a year later, I get a call from Tom. So seriously.
Out of the blue.
Just out of the blue, like, boom.
To come up on your phone, it says Tom Waits.
No,
a random number.
I just pick up the number and he and so he goes, "Hey, Mark, it's Tom." I said, "Hey, Tom," and he goes, "I hear you make some great records, and I know you produce a lot of your records. But I was wondering, is it possible if you could come and make a record for me, where you just kind of like, you know, record it and can mix it?" I said, "Yeah, I do that all the time for a lot of people, and it'd be, you know, easy for me to do." And he says, "Yeah, well, just, you know, the way we work is me and my wife, Kathleen, we kind of deal with the production end and writing and all that stuff." I said, "Okay, great. Yeah. So And so what happened is I was working out of a place in LA in a beautiful, big, huge mansion called the Paramore. And it was like a 1920s movie star estate that was once owned by Anthony Marino. And he married Daisy Canfield, who was oil family from LA, and her father built this amazing place. So that's where I made Listen's record. And so I invited Tom and his wife Kathleen down to LA because they live up by San Francisco, Petaluma area. And so they came down, and Tom says, I've been, you know, working on these songs, and I go into the bathroom late at night while everybody's sleeping, and I got this 4-track cassette. And what I do is I've been making these rhythms with my mouth. And then I hit it with a pan. And so he had all of these songs and all of these different rhythms that he'd come up with on this 4-track cassette, but he had no way to hear these songs unless he played it off this 4-track cassette. And I said, let's go through all the ones you got. I'll make a CD for you, and you can take it home with you, and you can listen to it, and we can pick the best ones. And I said, you know, once we pick the best ones, we'll re-record them, you know, with my, you know, really nice equipment and, you know, nice microphones. And so we said, all right. So, and I said, you know, could you come down here and, you know, finish? And he goes, no, I can't work here. I got to stay close to the family and stuff like that. And so Tom, he lives out past Petaluma. And if he wants to go to a studio, it's like 2.5-3 hours away. Prairie Sound, I think, is the closest one. So I said, well, let me, he says, but I found this building at the end of my driveway. It's the old schoolhouse. And he said, will you come up and look at it? And I said, yeah. And so I flew up there and I looked at it, and it was exactly the same size as the Paramore. Mm. And so I said, yeah, I'll bring all the gear up. We'll make it here. And it's close for you. And like, so I went back to the Paramore, packed up all my gear, and drove it up there. So it was going to be for a couple of months. You know, we were camped up there. But the schoolhouse was also used for farmers to show off their livestock and their prize pigs and stuff like that. So we, in the middle of the record, I had to pull everything out so they could have this kind of like farm meeting and amazing thing go on there. But yeah, so that's became like the spot where we were made Real Gone. And it was a strange record where Tom, he can't really talk in normal terms of technically. Like if he wants you to turn the vocal up, he can't just say, turn the vocal up. He'll say, put a little more hair on it. Like, oh yeah, I'll put a little more hair on it. Like, here's the hair button. Like, that better? And like, so you got to like kind of think about what he's talking about. But, you know, it's like, you know, as, you know, when we first started recording, I was being pretty enthusiastic. I was excited about, you know, where we were going with this record and how it was sounding. And, you know, like I'd say, I'm more of a guerrilla recordist than I am. And I like to use different methods and stuff that is very lo-fi to people. And so by being too enthusiastic, I get this phone call. I'm staying in this hotel in Sebastopol. And he calls me. He goes, Mark, it's Tom. I said, hey, Tom. He goes, Mark, I'm feeling a little bit more like you're the pharmacist and I'm a patient. I said, okay. He goes, you're trying to prescribe me Zyaxidan and I need to be on Triaxadil. And I said, oh, yeah, yeah. He goes, but maybe I need to be on, on this drug. I need to. And so, in other words, shut up. Let me find my own way. And this is the way I work. So I said, okay, cool. And so throughout the record, there's always like, you know, different terms that he had for like, if we cut a take and it was like the first take and it just happened, it was natural. It was that one came out of the ground like a potato. Done. so it's, you know, he's got this kind of quirky kind of persona about him that he talks in a strange manner, but he drifts in and out of it. I think he puts it up on sometimes just to But when it's just me and him in the room, it just seems like he's just like a normal guy. And we can talk about anything.
You had Les Claypool on that album, right?
Les came in, and the drummer also from Primus.
Jay Lane?
No, they call him Brain.
Right.
Is it what's his real name? Brian, right?
Yeah, he's the original.
But somebody had spelt his name wrong, and they called him Brain. And so, yeah, so he was there. And so he was... It was an interesting, and then Mark Rebo from New York came in. Mark is kind of a master of crazy guitar sounds and amazing kind of rhythms and stuff like that. But he never played on a live with Tom on a record. He'd always overdubbed it afterwards.
The record is recorded live.
Yeah, this record is pretty live up the floor. Mm-hmm. And so during that, you know, like there was two bathrooms. There was a boys' bathroom and a girls' bathroom, and like in the schoolhouse, and it was still the board like went all the way around the ceiling with the alphabet on it and numbers and stuff like that. You could see it. But we had a setup in the girls' bathroom, and it had these stall doors. And so I put Brain in there, and I wasn't using microphones. I was using a Sony cassette player. It's like it has two speakers in it. It's got two microphones. Put a cassette in the front, and then you put it in record, and it has two lines out, and I would take those lines out. And what it is that for whatever reason that has this compression in it that makes everything sound more exciting than it actually is, because it's lo-fi. And so I had that in the bathroom, and I kept it on all the time so we could hear. So Brain had gone into the bathroom, and Tom goes, "What's that sound?" I go, "It's Brain. He's in the bathroom." Yes. Yeah. Right. You know, and then you hear him stop and open the stall door, and it slams. He goes, "What's that?" I go, "That's the stall door. It slammed." He goes, "I want to use that sound." And I said, "Okay, cool." And so I go in there and tell Brain, you know, like, tell him what you did, like, you know, slam the door, you know, in rhythm, so boom. And then when you hit the downbeat, hit the wall with this piece of wood, so it was boom. Boom, boom, boom. And so coming through this cassette deck, it was like this crazy, cool sound. You know, I was like, and I thought, ah, that's amazing. And so we cut the track with it on. And right at the very end of the song, that he pulls the door. The door falls off the hinges and hits the ground right in time. It's like, wow, pretty cool. And so Brain had his, what was his, called an MPC 60 drum machine. And he had it, because he lived in Frisco, it was like car culture there, like custom paintwork. And so he had his drum machine painted with this custom car paint, and it looked pretty sharp. So he took that sound of the door slamming and mixed it with, you know, some other kind of sample that he had. And that made it that sound. And then another time, Brain's back in there, and he's got a snare drum, and he's got a roll of gaffer tape, and he's taping the gaffer tape to mute this drum sound. And so Tom hears that, and he goes, "Well, what's that sound?" And I go, "He's got the gaffer tape. He's gaffing up his snare drum." He goes, "I want to use it." And so we had to get Brain to play with the gaffer tape. So it was like, and then he matched that with an 808 kick drum. So it was boom, 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 boom. And so it was this cool effect that was going on. Or I think it was a song, Make It Rain, or one of those, Make It Rain, or another one. But you hear it right away, like a shh, shh, right at the top of the song. So, yeah, so that was another kind of crazy sound that we got. And then he had invited his son to come do some scratching, because he liked to do the DJ thing. And so Tom says, "Here, Casey, take this $100, go into Frisco and get some vinyl." So Casey takes the $100 and he leaves in the morning. And then we hear him come back from Frisco, and Tom opens the door and says, "Oh, no." I go, "What? What happened?" He goes, "He put the vinyl on the back window." it warped all of the vinyl that he just bought. Anyways, we still did some scratching. It's pretty cool. And it was mostly just me and him half the time. And so there's a bunch of tracks that never made the record that I think should have, but they were political and at that time about Mark Rebo is Jewish, and he expressed some kind of concern about, because Tom, sometimes he reads stuff right out of the New York Times and lifts certain things, and he was using some names of some people that Mark Rebo thought he would get into trouble with if he named them, or they'd come after him. But, you know, with Tom, he married Kathleen, his wife, and they had some kids together. He doesn't like to go on tour or leave his house. And Kathleen said, yeah, we were in New York, and, you know, Tom freaked out, and he wouldn't go out on stage unless he had this kick drum with this painting of the Alps with these mountains on it. And it was at his mother's house in the Bronx. And so we had to send somebody out to the Bronx, keep the audience in there for an hour in this big, huge hall in New York. And so they finally got the kick drum there, and he agreed to go out on stage. And so, but he never played it. It just sat there. So he doesn't like to tour very often, and he does some TV stuff, but he's pretty particular.
Yeah.
He did a Black Rider. It was like a play that he had done in San Francisco. And so he had gotten Marianne Faithful to come in to do some of it, and another girl from Canada that maybe, I think she, remember her name, but she'd quit, and so Marianne was taking over. But it was interesting to see. I went to that play, and it was pretty cool. He had all the music in there. It was pretty interesting. But yeah, what a crazy environment to make records in.
Absolutely. Yeah, I want to talk about one more legend that you work with so many, but Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
Who you remixed A Song of Seagull, which was her first album.
Yeah.
How did that come about, and why did Joni want that remix?
Well, I'd known Joni from before mixing that record. She came in to sing on Brian Blade's jazz record. And so that was in Oxnard. And so I knew her from that, and I, recorded all her vocals on this record. And then what happened was this, somebody had called me from the CBC in Canada. They were going to be interviewing Joni at her house. And so they asked if I could come in, because they had saw this documentary piece that Neil had done about Making All the Noise. And they said, well, we want to have an all-Canadian crew too. And they said, would you come in and record her vocal for us? And, we'll match it up later. So I said, yeah, no problem. So went to Joni's house, and, she goes, oh, yeah, Elliot's been talking about you. Elliot Roberts was her manager and helping her out too at the same time. So she remembered me, and she goes, I need your help, and can you come back, after this and help me? And so, I said, yeah, sure, and went back up to her house a couple of days later, and she told me what she was looking to do. And she said, my first four records were all just acoustic and voice. But the very first one was produced by
David Crosby.
And she goes, David, he misproduced my record, and he made me double my guitar. And for all these years, I've never liked it. I never liked my first record, and it's got some great songs, but I want to get back. So I had to find the tapes, and most of them were on Cosby, Neil, Nash, multi-tracks.
Wow.
In between other songs.
Really?
Like, they had pieced a lot of the stuff together. Like, when they were working, they used the same role and put her on it and stuff like that. Some of it was done on acetate, which it's a different type of tape that you record on, more film type of stuff was done on acetate. But I got it all, and I transferred it into digital. So I was able to go to her house, and I was able to mix it right there in front of her. And so she'd just sit on the couch and smoke and, say how
she is. She active in how she wanted it to sound?
Oh, did she have a vision? Well, I would mix it the way I wanted it, and then I would make her a CD, and then she pulled same thing out on me that Dylan kind of did. Is there? She goes, I've been listening on my TV, and it sounds better with the Dolby off than with the Dolby's on. And I said, yeah, it's probably not a good reference. That's your only reference is to listen off of her TV. So anyways, we went a couple of rounds with kind of changing a couple of things where, that she wanted, but it was just more levels than anything because it was just a
good voice and it's
a joke. Yeah, yeah. So she just wanted some couple of pieces that were just thought the voice was a little loud on. So, but other than that, yeah. And so she had also, after I finished that, she had had a brain aneurysm, just like Neil had, you know, like bang. She lived in this beautiful house in Bel Air and by herself, you know. I thought, well, you should have a caretaker, somebody like that looks after you. And she had this, like these little dogs, and they're always jumping and she's always tripping over them. And this is just a disaster waiting, you know, you're going to fall one day, trip over the dog or whatever. But she ended up having that aneurysm and that slowed her down for a lot. And everything went quiet after that. And she was wanting to make like a box set. And so she wanted to include that first record in there also. That's why she wanted a remix.
She's performing at the Hollywood Bowl in the end of the year.
Yeah. Well, she just did the Grammy thing, and then she won for the Newport Jazz Festival. They recorded that, and that, so she won for like a live record.
Did you record anything with her playing?
Well, the thing is, she wouldn't play or sing. Mm-hmm. She just wanted me to mix, and then she wanted some drums on some tracks, and so I invited Brian Blade up to put some drums on a song called Strange Boy, which just had percussion on it. And then she's a big Jaco fan. Jaco played on a lot of records. And my friend Hal Cragen, he's a bass player, and he's just, Jaco everything. So I said to my friend, you can play like Jaco a little bit. So she said, get him over here. And so my friend Hal came over, and he played on a couple of the tracks that I had with her. And so she was directing him left and right. And so too hard, too soft. Like, she really was on him. Like, but he was such a Joni fan. And he just grateful for me that I invited him.
Did she have any stories of sharing anything about the original sessions for that first album? Anything that helped give you insight on how to better mix it now?
Not really. She just really wanted to get it back to sounding like her other records, that is just straight and clean.
That second guitar.
You get that, yeah. And then, but she doesn't consider herself a musician. She's an artist. Like, she thinks first she's a painter. Yeah. That's what she claims. And so, and then, but also, you know, as a musician, a lot of musicians are like, they can't believe she invented a chord change nobody had ever had made before. And so she developed that by herself. And so she was, definitely, by her peers, like, the top of the bunch for sure. But yeah, it was kind of interesting record to, to hang out and mix and but she was just chain smoking. I'm like, oh boy, like, still doing it. And so it was a nice, she was trying to put this, the compilation record of all of her records. And I said, Joni, like, do you have any of your records? He's like, nope, you don't have any of your records. Nope. He goes, I got divorced and he took all my records. And I thought, what do you mean? He's like, you don't have any of your records. So Larry Klein, she was married to this guy, Larry Klein, I guess 80s maybe. And Larry produced some of her records, or a couple of them.
So there are a lot of these stories, or these stories and other stories, are also in a book that you wrote called Listen Up.
That's correct. Yeah.
And also in your photographer as well. So you have taken a lot of pictures of these sessions and put them out in another book.
So this is my newest book. It's called Recording Icons / Creative Spaces. And so over the last 30 years, I've been doing what's called time-lapse photography. Because, if you take a camera and you put it up, person changes their face, the way they act, and just, but if you do time lapse, you capture people. I call it, like, it's National Geographic. I'm capturing these wild animals in their natural habitat. And so that's what I've been doing with Dylan and Joni and Neil. And so I've got some amazing photos of them singing and performing in the studios that I built for those records. And so it's architectural, it's, you know, creative, and, you know, you're getting all different kind of like views of, because you wouldn't be able to put a photographer in a studio and take photos and capture them in these kind of like, you know, these while they're singing, you know, so it's like having a photographer that's not there.
Yeah.
So it's, the new book is doing well. And so I've been doing a lot of book signings, and I've, in the meantime, I've been doing, I watch a lot of movies myself. And so I'm kind of a big James Bond fan, but I don't like to watch the films. I like to watch them with what's called, where the director talks about it and the, everybody else. So it's like a commentary. Right. So I've been doing, projecting the pictures from the book, and I do a commentary along with it. And then that turned into, those commentaries turned into, I've made a little film out of it now where I just show this film with my commentaries there. Right. So I don't have to do it off the cuff, but like, you know, making like I do here.
And you're working on a documentary as well.
Yeah. So this is the documentary that from that book. And so hopefully that will be all finished soon. And that will be another next step after that. Hopefully I can put that in some film festivals.
And yeah, man.
So I'm kind of going by Bob Dylan's rules. He said, anything over an hour is a waste of time. And so that's why all of the shows are 1 hour and he's off the stage. So, and I think it's, you know, these people don't have a lot of attention span these days. So, and, you know, a lot of movies are all quick edits, mm-hmm. bang, 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 to keep your attention. So I tried to do in this kind of a little documentary thing where you get a nice piece of music to listen to.
Yeah.
And then I talk about it. And then, so I just want to make sure that, you know, it's not, and then the music is still there underneath my commentary, but it makes for a pretty cool watch, you know, for, you know, learning, you know, like we've been talking here. I have these same stories in there too. So
awesome. And make fun too.
Yeah. Yeah. It should be. I'm working with this guy who used to be Rolling Stones editor, and now he's running Rolling Stones films. And I'm about to go to Jamaica, and then after Jamaica, I go to Barbados with this guy from New Orleans, Anders Osborne. And so they want to come and document on the sailboat where I'm going to make his record and outside of Barbados. It's going to be crazy. So hopefully they'll pick up with the doc, and they might be able to put it out for me. But it's all early stages of it. That would be a good home for me.
Yes.
You know.
Thank you for listening to the second part of this interview with Mark Howard. If you enjoyed it, please rate it, subscribe or share, and visit us at All Day Vinyl on Instagram.